This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 9th of November, 1953. The title of this lecture is Randomity, Anchor Points. This tape is 62 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions. Please note, this tape ends abruptly as did the original master recording.
November the 9th, first morning lecture. And this morning we're going to cover a summation of the materiel, as well as the material, of what we've been over here recently. First thing we're going to cover is randomity. And you'll be asked to explain now and then, what is this stuff called randomity? Do you eat it or smoke it? And you should have some explanation for it. Let's look at randomity. Randomity is the word for the ratio between predicted motion and unpredicted motion. Plus randomity would be all motion unpredicted. No motion predicted. That's absolute plus randomity. Absolute minus randomity would be all motion predicted, which of course is answered by the condition of no motion whatsoever. You saw in an earlier lecture, I gave a little demonstration here in class a couple of days ago to somebody who had had his havingness reduced. Now, I get this carefully. Yes, I said havingness. We mustn't run to somebody until we knock to pieces. We can, with present techniques, with ease, knock to pieces all of his automaticity, all his machinery to furnish him surprises, all of the gimmicks and whatnots that he's got stowed and hidden, and then take away, of course these are in the form of energy, more or less, and take away then large masses of energy. Why? Because this energy, although stored, is subject to randomity. It will produce randomity. So if we take away somebody's havingness, we put him into a no-motion category or a minus randomity category. We put him down to a point where either he doesn't have any motion, which is to say his energy exchanges and so forth are insufficient. He isn't making up any energy. He isn't. He just lost energy and lost energy and lost energy. See, he doesn't need energy to make him run. That again is something we introduce in order to create randomity. And we reduced all of this, all these particles. Well, the second we reduced all these particles, what do we got there that moves? Or if we reduced it to a wonderful pattern of where he knows exactly what's going to happen every time and knows it in advance, we, of course, have a condition of no motion or minus randomity. Now, minus randomity would be the same as saying minus unpredicted motion. So, when we say plus randomity, we say too much unpredicted motion. What we should say there, instead of really plus and minus, what would make it much plainer, is if we said an ultimate ratio and of unpredicted motion. We could write it in a mathematical form. We could say predicted motion, PM, and unpredicted motion, UM, and we could write this ratio PM over UM, and this for minus randomity would be PM infinity and UM zero, and for plus randomity it would be PM zero over UM infinity. Now, let me give you another look at this. Here's some fellow, you want to know exactly the state of mind, which is anxiety. This is a very valuable concept. Here we have a fellow driving down the road and he sees a truck. There's a big truck coming along, and there's a big, thick concrete ramp between the driver coming down the road and the truck. The fellow in a state of anxiety, which is to say, plus randomity, too much unpredicted motion. See, randomity is random motion, unpredicted, in other words. He'd be absolutely certain that truck, in the next 100 feet of travel, is going to jump the ramp and hit him. Well, that's very interesting because we figure this out by the mathematics of probabilities. We find out that he could hold 13 spades in at least about 360 consecutive games. The chances of that truck doing that would be about the same as holding 13 spades in a bridge hand for 359.8 games. That's about the record. Well, of course, the odds against holding one 13 spade hand in a bridge game are so great that whenever it happens, even on a social game, it's generally written up in the newspapers. Yet there's lots of hands of bridge out. Yet this fellow is so certain that he cannot predict the behavior of anchor points. In other words, that he does not own or direct anchor points. Just add all this together. He's so certain he doesn't own or predict the course of anchor points that he has gone on an inversion to the point where he's sure that the mission of anchor points consists of predicting him. And this you have as an undesirable condition. Now here again we have whether or not you are taking the motorcycle down the road or the motorcycle's taking you down the road. When the motorcycle is taking you down the road, you have achieved a plus randomity. That's plus randomity. Because motorcycles don't think well. They practically were never known to do even an elementary problem in arithmetic. Much less the neat and nice calculations which have to be made when they go between two trucks which are close together and passing. A lot of kids in search of plus randomity in the United States. This isn't true of Europe, by the way, or Great Britain. And in the United States, enough kids are so cut back and given a predictable existence that they almost go mad. The predictableness of their existence is so great that they don't feel that they have anything like a plus randomity. They've got minus randomity. They can't burn their hands on the stove. They can't have illnesses. They can't have malnutrition. They can't have minor deficiencies of equipment. They're playing Buck Rogers or something, and right away they have rocket pistols. And any day now, some department store will come out selling for $1.98 actual rocket pistols, and you have to have a helmet, and you have to have this helmet to go with the rocket pistols, so that they'll nullify the effect of the rocket pistol, but the rocket pistol will be very effective on parents. This will be an effort to get parents to buy helmets for rocket pistols so as to prevent this new occasion for plus randomity. So these kids go out, they can't have any real need of anything, and there's no doubt about it. If they go in the house or with muddy feet, they're going to get scolded. In other words, certainty, 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 certainty. Well, that's not good. So we get a condition of uncertainty as a desirable factor, but the second it goes into plus uncertainty, which is synonymous with, there is no difference between plus uncertainty and minus uncertainty, plus randomity and minus randomity, we have a situation where he'll take a motorcycle down the road. For the first block or two, just to make sure it's running, and then you cut it loose. And it, after that, takes him around. And of course, takes him into ditches and busts a collarbone and fractures his skull and gives him all sorts of desirable things known as pain, and beautiful sympathy, dramatic moments. Of course, the main thing that a child cannot do in America is be dramatic. Until a child is 21, he is, you are young, society says. Well, I'm awfully sorry, you can't work, you're no good, you can't put out any effort, you can't make any decisions, you are young. The horrible condemnation, you see, that's leveled against the child in this country. Compare this to the Roman civilizations, when the child was about 13 or 14, he was generally made a tribune, who happens to be a civil officer of some magnitude, or he's already serving in the armed forces, or he's already in a good condition of advancement on the road to being self-supporting. By the time he's 15, of course, he's an old married man. And from the time of 12, he has had a position in the family council. Although the Roman father had the power of life and death over members of the family, youth was accorded great respect. This was also true in the Arabian civilization. It's also true today, still true in Europe, still true in England. Youth is accorded respect, but it's an astonishing thing, an American kid suddenly drifting abroad. I know I had this experience. And drifting around the world and being Mr. Hubbard. It didn't strike me as peculiar, you see, because I was in my middle teens. It wasn't peculiar. And my friends were old men, middle-aged men, young men, and so on. Age didn't seem to have anything to do with it. And then all of a sudden, well, I fortunately never saw much of a high school. High school and I never quite collapsed terminals on each other. A fellow gave me a book and I read it up and passed the New York Regents and got into engineering school. That was a fluke too, because they had lost the New York Regent examinations and something of the sort, and they only looked up the IQ test they had made on me. So they said, well, he passed. Got into engineering school, and it was a great surprise to everybody that you couldn't possibly get grades this low, this consistently, and still stay in the school. This was an impossible thing, but I managed it again simply by being the associate editor of the newspaper in my freshman year and writing nasty articles about professors. Now, this was a form of blackmail. I even got into a classroom every once in a while to see if any friend had me stuck there. But, you see, this kind of a condition was immediately bred about by an instant revolt on my part. Because, after all, I was even then pretty old to be entering a university. And these characters, these dogs, they call me Hubbard. And I would say something on the subject of art or literature. They'd say, well, yes. When you're older, you'll know more about this. You are here to learn how to think and get some experience, so possibly you will be able to get along in life sometime later. And imagine when you're about 28 and thoroughly educated, then somebody might listen to an opinion of yours. But right now, so I'm afraid that, to be very colloquial, I said something very, very nasty about the whole organization. And in view of the fact that my parents made me stay in college, I just suffered through the thing, one way or the other. Why? Well, it's because of this same phobia. So I came up against it, so I can appreciate and sympathize with what these young people do here in America. These kids get into their teens and nobody gives them any respect or pays any attention to them. They got good brains, they got fast reaction time, they know what they're doing, but they're rendered very, very anxious about the whole thing because they're 100% controlled by the society. The society won't let them make a decision. If the society will not let them make a decision, then actually they're in somebody else's minus randomity. But that's real plus randomity where they're concerned. They can't make a decision. Nothing they say is going to stick. And so their decision is relegated to being at the wheel or on the handlebars of something and dumping it. They can make that decision. People won't argue with them too much if they're dead enough or if they're in trouble enough. You see the depth of seriousness which has to be entered here at a level of independent decision. So we have another ratio at work. We have the level of seriousness of the situation which demands a situation. Imagine a man of this seriousness level, decisional level thing. Imagine him running a country. Actually, he couldn't even vaguely run a country. He couldn't run a kitty car. Because his level of decision has to be dump the motorcycle into the ditch to get a point where he's really making a decision. And these boys that go around and tell a country, this is an emergency. Now we can act because, see, they're being handled by anchor points. And every time you hear somebody in an organization start talking in terms of this is an emergency, you can spot him right exactly on the tone scale with randomity. What is that man's level of certainty? He feels he cannot predict motion, and that motion is about to predict him. Therefore, his level of uncertainty is very dangerously close to psychotic. And yet, mobs and so forth on this side of the world and in other parts of the world today put those men instinctively in the command of things. This guy can't get anything done. He couldn't do anything. It's impossible. How can he do anything if he can't predict motion? He isn't going to make a decision then. He knows it wouldn't work. But he has to feel then that the situation is forced upon him before he can act. Or he must be in a very dangerous situation before he can act. So he puts himself in a dangerous situation. He goes and buys a motorcycle and opens its throttle, makes sure the throttle's running, and then takes his hand off the handlebars, puts 2 feet on the gas tank, lights a cigarette. And then he says, Mom and Pop, or American public, or Yugoslavian public, gee, Mom, gee, Pop, I'm awful sorry, but a tire blew out or something of this sort, and it could happen to anybody. And just at that moment, a truck cut across the road, and I had to dodge, and that's why I'm in the hospital with a fractured skull, and why you are bankrupt. So, we got to have taxes, 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 taxes to meet the emergency, the emergency, the emergency, the emergency. Oh, no. These guys can't predict motion. In other words, they stand convicted by their own statements. Now, what's this got to do with a preclear? It's got a lot to do with a preclear, an enormous amount to do with a preclear. Because your preclear is as well as he can make a decision. He can make decisions as well as he can certainly establish and position anchor points. He is as able as he is not himself predicted and as he predicts. He is as much source as he can predict the position of anchor points. And he is as much sane as anchor points will behave around him. Because don't forget that a pretty good, well-off man is carrying an awful lot of machinery and is in contact with a tremendous amount of machinery which actually does the prediction of these anchor points in the first place. So what's this problem? It's merely a problem of being able to place an anchor point well and actually. Now, does this have anything to do with the native potential or ability of an individual? No, sir. That is another factor. A person's ability is not established by the mass of anchor points hitting him or the mass of anchor points he's putting out. In other words, we've got another factor here. This person runs on a plus and minus randomity on the ratio of 100 billion anchor point lots. See? I mean, it takes this many anchor points to swap him and so forth. What's he do? He immediately starts out handling large quantities of anchor points, and what becomes unpredictable to him are large quantities of anchor points. We have individual potential or capacity, capacitance. It is another factor. It is not all men are created equal. Every person has his own capacity. Now we find this person, let us say, he's handling 100 billion anchor point lots, and he's found out that they've gotten terrifically unpredictable lately. So he just kind of pulls in and occludes and closes down and doesn't look and shuts up shop, relatively speaking. And then he continues to run and predict anchor points on 10,000 anchor point lots. He shut down on 100,000 anchor point lots. And then we get this other person who deals customarily in two anchor point lots. And this person has one anchor point backfire, and they're immediately then in a plus-minus balance, one anchor point. And then the other one trembles one day while they're moving it from one place to the other, immediately in a plus randomity and as anxious as can be. See? There's a difference here. That difference, to some degree, is native. And to another degree, merely marks where the person is on the messed universe spiral. People who are earlier on the spirals, because the creature is always running slower in his own automaticity, earlier on the spirals, he's still accustomed to handling large amounts of anchor points. Later on the spiral, he's handling darn few. This is your difference of so on. Well, people will get into a situation where they don't want to be promoted. There's the professional private. There's the professional clerk. One day, the clerk's been very reliable for 20 years, and the boss comes in, and the boss says, how about having a better job? And the clerk says, what? Well, the boss says, well, there's somebody got to take over the shipping department. You're up. This guy goes to pieces. He's been completely predictable. He's been in good shape for all these years. But what was his anchor point capacitance? It was something on the order of 1,000 file cards. That was the number of anchor points he customarily handled, and all of a sudden he had to handle 10,000 items of one kind and 30,000 of another kind. Just the quantity there all by itself was plus randomity. Right away, quick. He just can't handle that many anchor points. So the mere fact of a mass of anchor points can convince people that the situation can't be predicted. See that? Now we're into the inertia of the masses. We have somebody standing around. He's waving a small red flag on a platform or something of the sort, and he's talking about the will of the masses. This is something like somebody talking about the will of ridges. All he's doing is saying the political philosophy which I espouse depends entirely for any ability to predict whatsoever upon the agreement of this large mass, because the people I'm with, they can't predict masses of people. Right? They can't do that. They have to let the people predict themselves. Well, there's too much of that on the lower end of the scale, because you find large masses of particles when they get into the shape that the fourth invader forces put the people here on Earth in shape. they don't know how to predict themselves. It's fascinating to me over the weekend here. Quite some time I've processed in England and here. Quite a few old-time celebrities. People who had the show on the road, and they've still got it on the road. These people are powerhouses. You know, practically none of them have ever been through the Between Lives area. They just sort of happened in lately. See the difference there? You say, blow up that ridge, and that ridge contains 10 to the 100th power anchor points, they say, okay, boom, the body jumps, they say, okay. Now you say to somebody else, all right, now blow up that ridge. Pop. That's just the position they are. Now, here in this environment, they've been knocked around pretty badly on this between lines thing. You don't have to take that factually. That's all parasitology, of course. Nothing to do with it. But you run these people up toward Mars, and they say, gee, that's a funny-looking planet. Look at it pulsate. And you say, pulsate? You say, oh, yeah, I don't know. There's some kind of energy spreeing around the darn thing. Look at that. Think I'll go down and take you. Say, all right, I'll be in the room. And I said, what's the matter? That hurt me. You'd say, well, not unless you match terminals with it, and you were all set. All right. This is all sounds as though I'm coloring this situation a little bit, pre-clear, pre-clear. But the difference of cases that you get, this really isn't an apparent factor. This really doesn't come to the attention of the auditor. If the fellow is in a plus randomity state on 10 billion anchor points, he's still functioning, well, he can take it. I mean, if he's on a plus randomity state on 5 anchor points, he can take it. 5 anchor points. But the only place it influences an auditor is if the fellow just doesn't seem to be able to realize something about his case or about this or about that. You look at this very carefully and you say, well, I guess this guy really has a plus randomity. And we start jarring these things loose and they start going out in unpredicted fashions. This fellow could go down tone scale like mad because we've gotten immediately above his level to handle the situation. Explain anything to you? A pre-clear could then be on a plus, 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 plus randomity, but in balance. And then you come along, you dog, and you shake loose a couple of anchor points. And this is plus randomity to him. Now, how he ever got the rest of this stuff in balance, you'll never know. But you shake loose these two anchor points, and they almost blow his brains out. Well, how are you going to handle this terrific mass of stuff? Well, fortunately, you can handle it. You can simply get him away from it, exteriorize him swiftly. Because what's he doing? He's holding everything into what he considers to be a necessary balance. And this necessary balance is only necessary because every time he lets go of something, he feels that he's going to get into a plus randomity situation. So the auditor comes along and he trots out this technique and that technique, all these subjective techniques. All the subjective techniques, when they hit this case, go by the boards. Just all of them. There aren't any that do anything for them. Because the fellow says, no, nothing happened. It didn't. His entire attention is holding those anchor points up. Now, you can understand that he can be holding up 10 to the 1,000th power of anchor points in perfect balance around him, and his capacitance could be 50% of that. But the second that, I mean, he's got real powerful, but he's got this tremendous number of anchor points in his immediate vicinity, and he's holding them carefully in balance, and all of a sudden you come along and you remove one anchor point, and it's like somebody taking his finger out of the dike. It's just a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. He's sure that if he lets anything happen, that he'll never recover that balance again. So it takes exteriorization techniques. It takes techniques by which he can back off gracefully. And when you get it, he isn't going to put out any energy. And when you get him exteriorized, well exteriorized and stable to the present time, why, you get him outside of this mass of stuff because what he's in combat with is generally hung up on the body. So you get him away from the body geographically, and then he can start putting out energy, and he'll start heaving a sigh of relief. This stuff will start blowing up. Now you build him upscale to where he is in good condition by processing while he's exteriorized, and then you turn around and let him start hauling and slapping away at the body if you want to. And all of a sudden the body is pretty good condition, and he can interior, exterior. But he don't get into a plus randomity situation. Now let's do this in reverse. Let's understand what we've been leading up to and deliver the punchline on this. So many words.
This lecture is continued on side two of this cassette.
Let's do this in reverse. Let's get this fellow in the midst of a mass of anchor points which potentially can shift, which have different potentials, one side to the other side, which have all sorts of vacuums and so forth around that will swoop stuff in, and heavy pressure areas that will suddenly push stuff out, and negative charge areas that will start flows sweeping around madly. And we get him into this mass of stuff, and we lose him. He doesn't certainly have anything by which he can locate himself. Well, therefore, he has no perception, because everything he's looking at is black. In other words, anchor points in balance. No motion, please. In other words, no light. And we've got him there, and then we say to him, do this, do that, all of which is directed immediately toward unbalancing and running out an energy flow. And that's what a subjective technique does. It unbalances and seeks to unbalance and run out an energy flow. He looks subjectively into his being, and that's what he runs into. You see that? So, whereas subjective techniques have wonderful workability on anybody who is in a condition of minus randomity on anchor points, the second you move into a condition where the fellow has plus randomity on anchor points, they start to break down, and when they get to a fellow whose plus randomity is very great, whether it's two anchor points or a billion anchor points, whether his capacity is two or a billion, if the potential there in that bank is so heavy that he will move into what he considers to be a plus randomity situation, why, he'll do the techniques and he'll stir up anchor points, and then every once in a while he gets sick at his stomach. Well, now how long will it take? Because this fellow's going to take it very easy. How long would it take subjective techniques, in other words, Dianetics or early Scientology, how long would it take these subjective techniques to clear this man? Oh, brother. I have seen it happen in a couple of hundred hours of auditing. But boy, this was really chipping away. Double terminaling, and mock-ups, and self-analysis, this and that. Poco-a-poco, little by little, little by little. The guy's getting better and better and better all the time, gradually getting better, you see. And all the time, kind of trying to push you around a little bit, trying to say, why don't you make me, or push me around. Well, why don't you try out these techniques and make me get better all at once? Well, he knows darn well he couldn't do that. What he's asking is, now if you could locate me and get me away from these ridges, I know what I could do. Just let me out of here and let me at it. And you keep saying to him, all right, do this and do that and something else, none of which positively locates him. Now you tell him, now let's go into the next part of this. Now, you tell him, go out and run these subjective techniques, and he sort of goes into apathy and decides he'll run them. He'll handle large deposits of this and deposits of that. He's handling on the basis of these anchor points can handle him, but he'll brace up to it and do it little by little. This fellow's liable to do an awful lot of self-auditing because he doesn't trust somebody else to make a sudden noise or motion in his vicinity while he's being audited. And he doesn't want to be also the effect of an auditor. He's too much effect already, and an auditor, instead of helping him out, he feels, will add to the amount of randomity which he has. Therefore, he has to have altitude, which isn't altitude at all. Altitude is nothing but trustworthiness in an auditor. Predictability in the auditor, so far as calmness and following the code and knowing what he's doing is concerned. This one's got to be real cautious. You've got to be real careful about what he does for an auditor. As a matter of fact, it's fantastic that these people uniformly let me audit them, when they know very well that I often do on them experimental techniques to see what happens. But they only do this, I'm sure, on the basis they know I'll fish them out. And it would make a little, it'd be a little fun to them if they suddenly got shifted one way or the other, had a real effect. Because they're tired of these halfway kind of no held in place effects. Now we get down to the next line. The fellow is, when he's into plus randomity, he's into plus effect, isn't he? is into plus effect. That should be very obvious. So therefore, somebody who has depended too much on sensation and too little on looking is apt to get into a situation where the energy lines are condensed. And therefore, you have large masses of anchor points occupying small areas, and these areas will have to get real volatile. Then this person, of course, being in this situation, loses the idea that he can create anything, because every time he puts out a little beam and creates something, why, all these anchor points start shifting on him. Matter of fact, you can ask Gumfree Clear, who's very occluded and so forth, to put a small beam to the end of his nose, or put a small beam into his mouth from where he is, and he very often will just comply with that, and then just go, wow, this nauseated, or feel very degraded, or get very upset with you. Because the wavelength he's putting it out on is too close to missed or something of the sort. It's too influenced by the anchor points around him, and these anchor points are made then to shift too violently, too quick. They give him a lurch and they make him feel sick. He won't put out another beam either. He sits around and waits for you to think of something else right now. Now, here's also the story of the Freaklier who exteriorizes and interiorizes and doesn't exteriorize again. He exteriorized, generated a little energy, collapsed the banks, made it unfamiliar inside, and then you move him back in, and he's all of a sudden in the middle of all these anchor points, and they're disturbed now, and so he becomes more disoriented than before. And so, being lost, is unable to cope with the situation and sort of goes into apathy about moving out once more. This also happens to somebody who moves into a ridge, and because he's generating energy at the time he does, blows up the ridge. But in all these cases, the only cases you'll have any trouble with are those cases which too closely match the wavelength of barriers of whatever kind. We're in the second part of that. Barriers. Understand a barrier. You have to understand randomity. How could a barrier exist unless there was some randomity? You're trying to look and something doesn't want you to look. It's trying to look and you don't want it to look. So you get a no-look zone. You have to match its wavelength and block it. And so a barrier is formed. Match its wavelength and block it, which is resistance. You must have chosen something out for randomity before you wouldn't permit looking, like this society has chosen out sex. And then match terminals with it, and of course then all energy generated is going to be that. That's elementary. But that's the way you make barriers. When barriers exist, then a person is relegated to a shorter look, which we call feeling. For feeling to exist, really, on an automaticity basis, there must have been a barrier. So there's some philosopher or other used to argue that sex wouldn't be any good at all in the society if it weren't forbidden. Well, it's a possibility. Certainly wouldn't get much aberration out of it if its lookingness wasn't all cut to pieces. But this fellow already had passed the point where he thought there was any fun in looking. Actually, it's more fun in looking than feeling, but people forget that. Any sensation is better than no sensation. All right, so we condense this down on barrier. Somebody chooses something out for randomity, and then that something looks at him, and a wavelength is furnished in his direction. He furnishes a wavelength back in order to block the incoming wave, and you have a barrier resulting from having chosen out randomity. You get a ridge. Of course, he can form a ridge all by himself, but you've got now other determinism entering in, which exceeds his own determinism sometimes. There you've built up immediately a situation where he has randomity. Well, people will do this. They'll simply do this in order to obtain a little bit of randomity. Unpredicted motion. You say that something else is doing it, therefore I can't predict it. We're down to the heart and soul of the thing. All right, the next thing the fellow does is
barriers build up and build up and build up, and after a while he goes out of feeling and he goes into the effort band. In other words, the barriers are so big and the waves handled are so big that they have a mass feel rather than an emotional feel. And that's a sort of a wooden sort of a feeling. It's non-emotional. When you've got a preclear who's in that band, he's worrying about not feeling happy, not being able to get a kick out of life. Everything is all sort of the same to him and so forth. Well, everything is sort of the same to a piece of steel or an old log lying in the forest or something of the sort. It's made out of effort. So he gets into this situation, and then when this effort caves in on him a little bit, the working man doesn't get as much thrill out of life. It's too routine, too much effort. And when this caves in on him even more closely, then he gets into a band of where he only dares put out a postulate-type wave. In other words, all waves, all barriers are so close now that when he puts out a postulate-type wave, very light, it doesn't too much disturb the other waves, other barriers around him, and so he can think. So we get into the band of thinkingness. Now, get this. You can actually start to cave in from the inside these external effort barriers to a thinking machine. So a fellow can run concepts. He can match terminal concepts. He can double terminal them. He can do all sorts of things with concepts, and it'll gradually chip away at God knows what slight ratio. But like the ants carrying a grain of wheat out of the silo, they'll empty it someday. Believe me, it'll someday be empty. Just chip away at it, this anchor point at a time sort of thing, tiny particle at a time, molecule at a time. Eventually these barriers will disappear. A fellow could think himself or match terminal himself or fool around and mock up himself. He'd have to match terminal against mock-ups in order to do this. Match terminal in brackets against mock-ups in brackets in order to restore predicted hattingness for lost unpredicted hattingness. That technique, I suppose, it carried on for a year or two or three or six. No, I don't think it had carried on for 6 years, actually. It probably even self-audited it for two or three years. It would pull one out of the fire, but it would be relatively uncomfortable at times because one would have a tendency to set up with great ease circuits. There are so many ridges around which will go into action that these ridges will start talking and do all sorts of things. But a fellow could do this theoretically. And as a matter of fact, more than theoretically, I know of a case that about 14 months was busy chopping and chewing away and chewing away and chopping at ridges and deposits of energy and vacuums and doing this and doing that. And I told him he'd be sorry for this two or three times. And he kind of said to me, yeah. Went on, and he wrote me not too long ago an extremely self-satisfied letter that he had finally merely stepped back of his head in perfectly good order. He's very snide about it. Look at that. It took him about 14 months. Practically day and night of self-auditing. Very, very grim. I wouldn't advise anybody to try it, but if a fellow has that much adventure in him, he shouldn't victimize his friends or something with the resulting ups and downs of his case. He simply ought to read what there is to know about concepts and then get himself a cabin in the Maine woods or the swamps of Florida or something like that and chew away. He'll get there. A process is just match terminal, double terminal. Concepts in brackets, and then get mock-ups in brackets out of self-analysis. He puts predicted havingness in return for the unpredicted. But if he didn't the unpredicted havingness, he wiped out. And if he didn't, however, rebalance on this, if he just kept on running concepts, he'd discharge without making any new energy deposit around, and he'd actually be disrupting and chewing up the GE's energy banks. Well, he can put back together again the GE energy banks simply by making mock-ups and not even paying any attention to what he's doing, because there's just enough energy around. But if he neglects this, the G will get hungrier and hungrier and hungrier, and first thing you know, start to pick up other people's fangs, totally mechanically. I mean, you just create a vacuum of effort. And so a vacuum of effort will cave in on it easily. You get people going into other people's valences and terminals collapsing and every other darn thing happening. All right, you can start a fellow out on getting the idea that thinking is condensed looking. And if you do this locationally, you know, think locationally, why, you can kind of chop him out of the ice a bit, and a lot of his circuits start breaking down. He'll start to realize this, but of course, as soon as this starts happening, the auditor should be very alert, because he starts thinking philosophically or something. And as soon as he starts thinking in that direction, it means that he just hit another energy barrier, and he's chewing away at it, and it's gone live now. And of course, it isn't automatic thinking he's doing. He just is thinking, you understand. Nothing wrong with thinking at all, enjoying himself. This isn't stimulus response. These thoughts aren't coming out of anything or suddenly occurring to him out of the energy banks. He's able to think at this point, and this newly discovered freedom or this brand new constriction that he's just experienced interests him a great deal. Now, what's condensed thinking? Occur to you if there is such a thing as condensed thinking? Well, if you don't believe this, well, I invite you to go down to a sanitarium someplace and weigh a word that you managed to pry out of one cycle. It'll weigh going above the equivalent of two or three pyramids. Condensed thinking can be, for our purposes, called a word. Words are condensed thinking. And people who are giving an enormous amount of weight to words aren't doing any thinking. Words are heavy. Now you start running these words, and gee, you get some weird effects. Wonderful. There's nothing wrong with using words, but when words are used for looking, emotion, effort, and thinking, oh boy. See, I mean, we're just completely out of the theta band. We just drop them into mess. Words are an excellent communication medium. Don't ever overlook the fact they're a mess communication medium. This is a very weird communication medium. And it's a lot of automaticity and so on. The fellow has to be pretty able to live in it very long without perishing. Actually, it's much, much better communication bands, but one has to have space in order to do this, and he mustn't have the feeling that other people's universes are all caving in on him all the time. He does this. So you see this phenomena of words. So when we tackled words with book one, we weren't far wrong. We weren't far wrong where the American public is concerned. I've been doing a little survey, and I've been finding something that was utterly staggering to me. That people are being their names. I've mentioned this before. But do you know that this is sufficiently slippy that it's the third thing you do if you're having any difficulty whatsoever in clinical procedure? You double terminal and mock up alternately, in brackets, the guy's name. And remember that we have often prefixes on the name. An artist, painter, always has painted by. And an author has by before the name. That's a real weird one. After a while, everything's going by him. And a motion picture director has directed by. So we must neglect these. And boy, don't ever neglect this. Women change their names when they get married. They normally don't like to do this. And if you don't think about it, as an auditor, you're liable to miss a key point in a case. What's the girl's maiden name? What's her full maiden name? And never miss this one, her nickname. And his or her nickname in school and at home. And you'll find out this person's known by probably 2, 3, 4 nicknames, one of which he really wanted to be and probably is tremendously significant. Now, do you want significance? Are you looking for significance? No. You're just trying to break the play, the drama. And that is the easiest way I know to break the drama. Now, I could classify names for you. Great ease. All these names are, and when anybody gets down to where a word is a substitute for any thinking, he's immediately in the category. I mean, where it's, he does no thinking, you know. I mean, it's just all words, college professor or something. He gets to a point, yeah, can you re-quote the something or other, the something or other, the something or other? And if you can all quote all this exactly in verbatim, why, then this would be a very clever person. Phooey. If you know the names of all the great operas and all the great paintings and all the great symphonies, you know the names of all these American composers and the brief history of each one. If you do, you're cultured. Eat with your knife. You're very cultured. So we have this strata of names, and I examined this. This was one of the first things I ever examined in the field of the mind. And that was the first definition of the word. Still a fascinating study. I've solved many a case merely by picking up the key word in the case and getting the first time it was defined. Light solution, you understand. I mean, just made the person feel better. Matched her only for 3 minutes, making it feel much better today for all those 2 or 3 hours of looking you'd have to do. So let's look at this and realize that the meaning he attaches to these words now is not the basic meaning in the automatic machine called language, which you're trying to take apart on the pre-clear as one of the first steps in any pre-clear walks in. So we've got these names, and they're the names of a communication particle. Never get the idea this person thinks he's source. They don't think they're source. So we've got arrive and depart. And there are the starting names and the non-starting names. There are the arrival names and the non-arrival names. There are conditional names and non-conditional names. There are object names and non-object names. One other category. Action and non-action names. Now, we could be tremendously learning. We could take up the next 2 or 3 months of study on this, but it isn't necessary. You've got a technique to let you find it all out anyhow. But you look at this pre-clear's name. You take it apart any way you can think of taking it apart. Then don't evaluate for the pre-clear. It just makes the pre-clear unhappy. Just have him double-terminal. And double-terminal his nicknames. You can do it in brackets. You should do it in brackets. Nicknames. Maiden name for the girl. Changes of names for the person. Very often a person will come to you who actually isn't under his own name. Got another name. Well, you don't have to know his own name to do it. So you just put your own name on there now. Hey, well. You'll be surprised how often this is true in society. It's getting less and less true because that type of randomity is not liked by inefficient and incapable police such as the FBI. They are so incapable and so inefficient that they have to have everybody, that the ideal of the police state is for everybody to be nailed down at a desk with a telephone number which won't change for the regrettable duration of his existence. And if he's right there and they've got a sign on him, preferably he should have his number tattooed across his brow and then be forbidden to wear a hat. You know, the cops get blinder and blinder and blinder. Now they've got fingerprints and so forth. It would amaze you the speed with which criminals were arrested 400 or 500 years ago by European police. They didn't even know about fingerprints. They knew all the criminals. See, simple. Criminals came in, you looked them over. Next time they came in, they say, hey, what the hell are you doing here? Well, well, Jimmy the Jitter, well, let's go. That's 100 lashes and 40 years on the galleys. They're real mean in those days, they're real positive. But today, well, they've got the fingerprints, and they're very nice. The more nice these laws get, the less human they get, by the way. They get nicer and nicer. By the way, did you ever read Victor Hugo, his stories of crime? So on. This criminal's just doing fine, but one day, why, he's on the police force. Not much different today. Anybody who's really good on the police force is just on a reverse vector of a beautiful life of crime he's led recently. Someday I'm going to get J. Edgar on the 80-meter. Say, J. Edgar, I want to really test you on this E-meter and show you how it works.
How many lives ago were you a criminal? Oh, last life, huh?
What bank? Chicago? Chicago? Oh, I see. Head of the Scrapelli mob, huh? Ah, now we got it. That's the way they go. They flick back and forth because this is a game of barriers called cops and robbers. And the cops can't exist unless you have robbers. The robbers can't exist unless you have cops. And the innocent bystander is the other 99% of the population. And the cops and robbers, the game of, actually make criminals in ratio to the amount of action which they produce between each other and catch other people on the run. A state deteriorates exactly in ratio to the deterioration of its police system. The rottener the police system, the worse off the state, till the police system is strictly a criminal system. In other words, the cop identifies at last with a criminal, and you can't tell the difference. Then he has to make the decent people the criminals. You see, in order to have a game. Deteriorating barriers, cross-identification with. Two or three lives go, this guy's enormous, he's Dick Turpin or somebody. And then we find him as the chief of police of London. Couple lives later. He is playing the same game. Somebody set up a barrier there called crime. And when he sets up this barrier crime, why, after that, you just get back and forth across this barrier, and it deteriorates because it's an automatic machine. Everybody starts running slower than it. For instance, I imagine there's many a potential Superman in the world today who really sighs for the complete lack of those wonderful villains in writing, by the way. It's the villain who makes the story. And those wonderful heroes, these supermen, can't be heroes at all unless they got real good villains. And Dick Tracy and the television film they make for Superman, gee, they have mean villains. Boy, I wonder where they get those villains so they can have such a good game. It's really a tribute to the society that can produce good villains like that. No game. You understand this barrier system work when you look at that. You should understand it pretty well. All right, people are down on an identification level now where they're the identification. Is your brief clear? He's many things beside this, but this is a very brief way of stating it. Is your freak clear of Satan and knows it? No. Is he a buddy and knows it? No. Is he a Satan plus body and knows it? Oh my God, no. Is he a name and knows it? No. He is a name and doesn't know it. I don't know where that puts him on the negative dynamic. That's where he's gone. Name and doesn't know. Anytime you're having a lot of trouble with a pre-clear, you're just fighting the most basic game you will pick up in the society. You're fighting his nicknames or his given name or his Christian name or a combination thereof. Fascinating. I knew one guy who was in an anxiety state until I double-terminal the name of his wife. And the name of his wife was Purity. And this fellow came to me complaining of his own frigidity. And his wife was complaining about the number of promiscuous incidents which he was having around. Only thing there, the only significance about the whole thing was that the thing had significance, and he was not being a body even. He was not being a name even. He was being a name and didn't know it. See? And his wife was being a name and didn't know it. But in this case, we had caved into a point where he was being threatened by a word. Simple. This horrible, unseen, hidden menace in his vicinity was a word called purity.